season with black sheep on the fields of black wheat in the summer sun, in the thunder and the rain, in the thunder and the rain, on the rails of Ghost Latrine. Across the stream, there's a place I never been, but I stopped in for a dream, and I'm gone back again, just to slide beyond my pale and sail back on a sea of borrowed time. Stars don't rearrange. We'll sail her home again, and we'll march right to the gate like highwaymen and wait for the sky to turn a deeper blue and lonesome bloodless coup on borrowed time.
My word, I just had a horrible urge to wash my potato. And, God, I'm looking out at the world and trying to figure out what the hell is really going on. And I'm looking out there and seeing a lot of people wake up, and I'm seeing just the society crumble and trying to put it all together. And so Ramona and I decided we were going to do a show, the 100th Monkey Radio.
Well, yay! It's
a poem. That's almost a poem. Decided to do a show, the 100th Monkey Radio. Okay. Anyway, well, welcome to the 100th Monkey Radio, guys. That was, as you can tell, we're really
professional
on our intro stuff. Tonight, well, first of all, we've got some little monkeys here that we just picked up. Little 8-gig gig sticks that... These things are awesome. We found them, and they're perfect for the show. And what we're going to do is we're going to stick the first season, which will go all the way from November 17th of 2010 all the way through the end of this year, which is this is our last show of this year. So we're going to put all these on big sticks, and for the first 10 gig sticks that sell – we're going to sell them for $40. That'll be all the shows that we've had for, what is that, 59 shows now, Ramon?
60 shows. This is our 60th show.
This is our 60th show. So you'll get 60 shows.
60 shows of me dealing with you.
Yeah. 60 shows. All of them, I was going to say high quality, but... No, you guys like, if you like the 100th Monkey, guys, this would help do two things. This will give you a place where you can have all of our shows in one spot for just plug into your computer and whatever, and off you go. And anyway,
yeah. And if we can fit it in, we will also include some our unofficial show that was our first show that we did just for YouTube. And
there's a couple other extras in there that we have done in the last year that we'll try to add on here if provided the room is available. I think there may be room to get everything that I'm envisioning on here, but I have to wait and see as I put
that. Yeah. If we can also fit on there really quickly, we'll put on the the YouTube videos that we did with Bob Dean and James Gilliland, the video interview. Who else do we do?
George Kavassalis.
Oh, yeah. Let's not forget it's Georgie.
So we'll get as much as that on there as we can. And I think it'll be a good deal. It'll help us out a little bit with the what we're doing here. And you guys will have a nice little rubber monkey to hang around, put on your keychain. So anyways, the first 10, we're going to let go for $40 a piece. And if you're in the United States, continental U.S., shipping and handling is free. If you're overseas, then we'll probably have to charge you for shipping. But that's still, I mean, $40 for the whole season. You can't beat that. So anyways, tonight we have
author. Oh, wait, before we get into that, thank you for all those being members. And if you like the first hour, please join us the second hour. We kept the membership as cheap as possible. And just want to say thank you to Roheen for inviting me down to the to meet up with them. I had a great time and great conversation.
Oh, yeah. We haven't really talked about that much. Cool.
Yeah. As you can tell, we're really excited to get our guest on. This is his first show, isn't it?
Yeah, I do believe so. So,
we have an exclusive.
There we go.
Hello?
We've got author Dan Kelly here with us tonight. He's the author of Pagan Streams, An Inquiry into the Origins of the Bible. Dan Kelly was born in 1973 in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Dan has always been interested in folk tales and mythology, and at an early age, he began comparing Bible stories to the myths and legends of various ancient cultures. In 2011, Dan published his first book entitled Pagan Streams, An Inquiry into the Origins of the Bible. This book presents ancient myths and folk tales from all around the globe that parallel specific Bible stories and unequivocally proves that there are authors of the Bible often borrowed from stories which had long been circulating far and wide throughout the ancient world. Dan believes that a greater understanding of the true Gnostic origins of Judeo-Christianity can contribute to the greater appreciation of humanity's common spiritual heritage. Currently, Dan resides in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and when not writing books, makes his living as a gardener and musician. Along with his true we'll have to ask that one. Dan performs his folk rock in his folk rock band, the Telluric Currents. In 2009, they released their first CD, A Dog and a Gun, and are currently at work on the follow-up, which is expected to be released on December 21st, 2012. Oh, nice date, depending on how one interprets the ancient Mayan ruins. And that bumper music you heard, which you'll be able to hear the full version of that in the second hour, was from that CD. So welcome to the show tonight, Dan. How are you doing?
Hey, can you hear me?
Show. Yeah, we hear you perfectly.
Oh, great. How are you guys doing? Thanks for having me on.
Oh, great. Man, great.
I'm
great
a big
to
fan.
Great to have you here, Dan. We like to see people taking the steps to get their voice out there. If you've got an interest about something, Mike.
Excellent. Go too far. That's my trusty Burrow Quacklebean. He's my partner in my folk rock band. It's just me and Quacklebean. So I think there was a little email error there, but the word was Burrow. But anyway, that's a whole nother story. I don't want to get you sidetracked. Quacklebean's down in South America right now. So.
Oh, nice.
Forget him.
Tell us a little bit about yourself, Dan. What actually sparked your interest into – I know in your bio there you said you've always kind of been interested in this stuff. But was there something that really sparked your interest into really starting to delve deeper into this stuff and compiling all this information?
I always liked stories, like old stories, and I always read, like fairy tales and things as a kid. And I guess – and I was raised, Catholic and religious, and I had a big Bible comic book when I was a kid, and I really kind of knew the Bible pretty well as a little kid. And I remember just being in the school library and finding parallels to Jacob and Esau, I think in like a Norse book or something. And it was just like, wait, this is strange. And, you know, just looking around and you find these parallels to from, you know, pagan parts of the world to these stories that I'm familiar with from the Bible. And it was just an interesting thing. And that's me and, you know, maybe third grade or something, I guess is how it started. I could say that I guess when I was like 11, a neighbor of ours gave us a book he inherited that was written in the 1800s, this huge antique book called The Life of the Blessed Virgin, written by a French abbot who, you know, in like 1830, you know, the head of some big monastery in France. But the whole beginning of that book made comparisons between pagan myths and Bible stories, kind of limited to the Adam and Eve and Noah and the flood, and then some stuff to Jesus Christ. And I'm getting a little echo here, but this book was by this French abbot named Orsini, and that fascinated me. You know, he wasn't using it to say that the Bible was not a, you know, obviously he was using that as proof that the Bible was true because these stories filtered around the world. But it got me thinking about it, I guess, and something I always came back to.
So
one thing I will say about the book, it reminds me a lot of Joseph Campbell's style and how very well you tied in all these different mythologies with the Bible and the references you give. It's an amazingly well put. Thanks. How long did it take you to put this together?
Thanks for the compliment. I mean, it took.
Oh no, you have to send us a check later.
I've been paying Tom for a couple of weeks now. No, it's I started in 1995. I actually, when I was like 21, I'm 38 now, but when I was 21, I was with a religious order for a while. I thought I might become a friar or a monk, you know, or a brother, possibly a priest. But I started doing this kind of research back then, and my intentions were different then. I guess it was kind of like to prove the Bible's divine origins, you know, using mythology. And I had already had some information from when I was a kid, but that research back at that time sort of convinced me once and for all that no, it was the other way around. You know, particularly with the Old Testament, the authors of the Bible borrowed pagan myths. You know, they were writing allegories. So I guess that was 95. Then I put that down for years, you know, and I picked it up in about 2008. So 8, 9, 10, 11. You know, off and on, it took about 3.5 years, I would say, to write the book since 2008.
So what are some of the major differences between I won't say differences. You know, when I went through the Christianity thing in the early 90s, and, you know, when I go into things, I kind of go a little overboard sometimes. And I really threw myself into it quite heavily and
joined the club.
Cover to cover and really trying to understand the deepest meanings that I could possibly find out of the book. And I just kept having this gnawing feeling inside me, and things like the Book of Revelations is actually what saved me. I won't say saved me, but that Book of Revelations, there were a few passages in there that actually made me check myself. Like the one in there where it says, "Take this book and eat it, and it'll be sweet to the taste, and it'll be sour in your stomach." That one right there. Because I was reading that book, and everything sounded sweet and everything, but there was just something that just was not sitting right with me. And so, what are some of the real apparent ones that something that you can easily find?
Are you saying parallels, or are you or are, what are some parallels, do you mean? Or? So,
well, some of the mythologies that were, I hate to use plagiarized, but.
Yeah, I would say, I mean, I see it as they were borrowing myths and stories, and I'm talking about the Old Testament here, that were commonly being used. But the authors of the Bible, I mean, they didn't really expect it to be taken as history, the original tradition. You know, I mean, Samson is a very simple one. I mean, if you read it, I mean, because Samson is pretty much limited to a solar myth, you know, Samson and his seven locks of hair. Apollo, the sun god of the Greeks, also had seven locks of hair. And, you know, Samson is tied up by the Philistines. And, you know, there's a concerning Japan, there's even a similar myth with, like, Susanoo, who is a Samson-like character who was caught, and you know, he's lured by the deceitful woman, kind of like Delilah, and he's lulled to sleep, and then they tie his hair to the rafters of the building, and then Susanoo awakens and pulls down the whole building, and everybody gets killed. Kind of like Samson, if you're familiar with the Bible. At the end, Samson is chained to the pillars, and his hair grows back, his strength is in, it is in his hair. And he pulls the building down. Well, the hair represents the solar energy, which the strength of the sun, which gives life to Earth. And the building is kind of, in a way, depending how you look on it, being bound in the building is like the sun is enveloped by nature. There was a yin and yang thing with all these myths. Delilah is, if you're familiar with Taoism, the yang is the solar or the male energy kind of radiation, and the yin is the geospheric earthly energy. The solar energy is basically imbibed by the geospheric energy, and that's life. You know what I mean? That's how life works. And the
So you said something that led something off in my mind, which is when – so you have these characters that are like solar characters that get tied in – that get tied to the building and they pull it down. Mm-hmm. And you see it as like solar flares or sun rays.
Sun rays, not necessarily – I mean flares are part of it, but just the sun gives the sun gives out energy and information. Like the symbol of the Star of David is an old solar symbol. And esoteric traditions put a bell in that symbol because the sun is also giving out sound, not on an audible level, but that sound is creating form on Earth.
Yeah. So I was wondering, is that maybe some kind of reference to something that happens? Okay, so one way I look at it is you have the night that comes, and that could be like Delilah, and she binds up the sun. So now we don't have any sun for a few hours, and as the sun comes up, it's pulling down the building.
In a way, yeah, in a way, that's one way of looking at it, because night is a yin yang thing too. Night and day, winter is a yin, winter and but even just the earth itself, you know, materiality, it's really about it's about like growth, I guess you would say. David and Bathsheba is a similar myth. Bathsheba is bathing on the roof, and David goes and spies on her. He has an affair with her, and things go horribly wrong. They're not married. He shouldn't have been spying on her. You know, the offspring is stillborn. David is cursed, and everything goes wrong. But in that myth, Bathsheba is a similar thing. She represents the Mother Nature, geospheric energy, whatever you want to call it, and David is clearly the sun. And there's a similar myth with in Greek mythology where the hunter Actaeon spies upon the goddess Artemis or Diana in Roman bathing in a grotto with her nymphs. And when he spies upon her, he invades her privacy or whatever you want to however you want to say it, you know, that everything goes horrible for him. She transforms him into a stag, I think, or something. But basically he's cursed. But it's kind of like about there has to be a proper harmony between yin and yang. So the sun like if you have spring water, say, like a spring, if it's exposed to sunlight, it'll like a mountain spring coming out of a grotto. People always kept them shaded by rocks and trees. If it's exposed to sunlight, then it'll dry up. The water will become full of bacteria. It's too much of the solar energy.
There's a lot of solar and lunar, well, mainly solar innuendos in the book.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm just touching the surface. It's the hard part is to find where to start, because there's just so many examples and myths, and most of them are in the book. But I'm not like an encyclopedia in terms of everything that I wrote in the book. But there is a lot, and it's not really just about the sun. It's about how nature works, really. You know, and that's what they were trying to convey. The Gnostics, who wrote the Bible. And that tradition carried on, and the Essenes, who were well aware, I mean, the Essenes were around in the time of Jesus Christ, and they were well aware that that the Bible stories were allegorical. And that's, you know, Josephus mentions that, and Philo Judaeus, who's a first century historian, talks about how the Essenes, they kept the allegorical traditions of the Bible, and they also kept the traditions of other cultures, and they were Pythagoreans. They were followers of Pythagoras, or not followers, but they shared that tradition, who was the Greek sacred geometer. He was kind of started, not really started, but the most famous ancient practitioner of sacred geometry, I guess you would say.
Right. I mean, he tried to recover some of the ancient knowledge.
Right, and it must go back to Egypt.
They were trying to draw on ancient knowledge just the same as we're trying to draw on it now. From there, yeah. And finding that it goes even farther than them.
Mm-hmm. Oh. Yeah. So there was literalists in the first century. There's a lot of revisionism in the Bible. I mean, David, there was myths written into David, but there was also a group of people that, you know, they were trying to have some national pride, and they wanted David to just be, you know, the king who defeats all the enemies of the people. And, you know, they try to turn it all into a coherent, history that shows that they're, you know, better than their enemies. And it's not really what was intended, but that was grafted over it. You know, it was kind of – that's a layer that was put on top of the Bible, and that was inherited in, you know, unfortunately, in Roman Catholic and later Protestant traditions, that legalism, the Bible as like a true history and then as a legal document, really.
Right.
Yeah, it's – I'm just wondering, how does your parents feel about this book?
Funny you should ask. Well, I really haven't shared it. My dad passed away in 75, so
okay.
But my mom is a great influence on me. I mean, she's a Catholic, and I haven't really shared it with her because I don't know if she would really dig it, you know. But she's a really strong Christian, and I don't know. I don't think it would really upset the apple cart, because she's got – I mean, some people just have the core of it. You know, I mean, what did Jesus say? You know, love God with all your heart, soul, and might. Love your neighbor as yourself. I mean, that's really the whole of the law. These questions about, you know, the allegories of the Old Testament. I tried to tell my mom years ago, and she said, I don't want to hear about that Old Testament crap. So I don't think she really cares about the Old Testament anyway. And I mean, we have our arguments about the New Testament, you know, I mean, as – anybody who has family who may be more conventional Christians, you know, it's the way the culture is in America. I mean, everybody who's raised within that tradition has family probably who are more conventional than themselves. And it's how far do you want to get into it? You know, I have some siblings that I don't know if we agree, but in a sense doesn't matter that much. If you're getting the most important thing down, then you have it all down, you know, whether you believe in reincarnation or whether you believe in anything like that.
Yeah. Right.
I want to get a little bit into the I don't know if you want to do this in this hour or in the second hour, but a little bit into the birth of Jesus, being that this show will air the 24th.
The 25th.
Merry Christmas, everyone.
Oh, yeah.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
I just feel like...
How rude of you guys.
Did you hear that?
Yeah. Merry Christmas. Happy solstice. Today, the sun starts its trek back up in the sky.
Happy Hanukkah.
All those solar holidays that you will... I'll put it this way. All those holidays you celebrate the sun on, whether it's S-U-N or S-O-N, either way.
Yep.
So speaking of S-U-N, according to the there were three planets rising when Jesus was born, and that wasn't December 25th, correct?
Most people presume that Jesus was not actually born on December 25th. I think a lot of, you know, that's, they just sort of, I don't know. I mean, I don't know what they teach in Protestant, but I think I was raised to believe that they just sort of took that date because it was already a pretty happening time for the pagans and they didn't want to give it up, you know?
Saturnalia.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's, there is a huge sun element, obviously, but it's just part of it, I would say. That's part of the sun, if you talk about the logos, which is what they describe Jesus as in John, at least, and John is very different than the other three biblical gospels, but he calls Jesus the logos, and the logos means like the builder of God, the word of God, and the sun, in a sense, is God's builder. Not exclusively, because I don't think they equated Jesus as the sun in the original Christian tradition, but the sun, really everything is built on this earth by the energy and patterns of information that are coming from the sun, really, by way of sound waves. And it's really proven. I think I write in my book about the Chaldney plates and the cymatics, the experiments by Hans Jenny, that just with sound waves you can create every organic pattern found in nature, and by spreading sand on plates or glycerin on plates and vibrating them at different frequencies, and you get the spots of animals, you get all the different types of patterns in plants and even vertebrae and circulatory systems. It's amazing, and that's what the sun is sending, vibrations. And so they were really why wouldn't they think of the sun as, you know, the source of life and the source of information? But I mean, where's the sun come from? I mean, it really all goes back to God, of course, the supreme creator. So it's,
yeah, I think the Gnostics, really, the material that I've seen, there was so much more than, I'm sure there was so much more and so much deeper understanding as far as the material that they put down, like the stuff from the Nag Hammadi, the stuff like the Book of Thomas and the Book of Mary. Oh, my God, you know, women were considered equals.
The Gospel of Mary Magdalene.
I mean, it was not, and I got perverted and twisted completely, you know, bass ackwards and integrated and became a second class human, servant of man. Where did this all, was this all, was this all, I don't know. This is all New Testament stuff where women got screwed up so bad in from what I've seen.
Yeah, I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head right there. I mean, if you look at it, I mean, Rome, ancient Rome was the – and this is just kind of my interpretation in a way, but one thing we know about Rome, it was a very patriarchal society. I mean, and they kind of had a stranglehold on the West. I mean, Judaism, a lot of people say, is a matriarchy disguised as a patriarchy. So I don't know, but it's Jesus. You know, apparently some of the apostles were pretty conventional people. You know, I mean, you have Peter and Andrew arguing with Mary Magdalene in the Gospel of Mary, and you know they're pretty upset that you know a woman is you know presuming to tell them something. So I think the break was just the conventional people, even some of them with good intentions, that were they just weren't ready for the kind of equality that right. Jesus was teaching.
Right.
But
so in a nutshell, just try to put this out there, if you would. What do you see in your own humble opinion as the teaching of Jesus? What is the teaching of Jesus in your humble opinion?
It's so simple that, I mean, there's so much, it's the whole, you could say Gnosticism is like as above, so below. The correspondences on every level are infinite. You can get scientific knowledge out of the gospel, but the basic is, you have to start with the basic, which is the spiritual and the moral. I would say forgiving and living from the heart. You know, there's nothing more dangerous than intellect without heart, which goes back to Rome. You know, the most sick are the most in need of the doctor. And where did Jesus show up? You know, in the midst of, you know, practically the low point of human nature. I don't know if you've heard of the Kali Yuga, the Indian system of yugas. Oh, yeah. That we go in cycles. Yes. So according to even the Hindu cosmology, you know, they're heading into the low point of the Kali Yuga at that point in history towards it. I mean, you have just like really depraved empires, especially Rome. And Jesus comes into that, matrix and I guess prevents, a complete collapse. God knows what could have happened, you know, without Christianity is all about the heart. You know what I mean? So as much as they messed it up, that really did survive. I mean, even within Catholicism, I mean, as bad as some of those popes was, you know, where you have St. Francis of Assisi. And I mean, he's a guy in the 12th century that brought it back to or 13th century brought it back to the heart, you know. And he was within the Catholic system, and there was people doing the same thing as he did who were, you know, on the other, you know, not within the – who were burned as heretics, you know, but they were really right. Saying the same thing. I don't know what St. Francis – what his theology was, because every biography about him had to go through the Inquisition. So, you know, I always wonder, was he – really as orthodox as we're led to believe, because they, at the same time as they're writing these biographies of Francis, that, you know, in the decade that he's killed, the Pope launches a crusade and they slaughter 50,000, you know, Gnostic Christians, heretics, quote unquote heretics, in the south of France called the Cathars. Well, these are Christians in Europe, you know, whole cities and towns of them, and they're just slaughtered wholesale, you know, under the Inquisition. So
yeah.
You know, that's how bad it got. But I think things could have gotten, you know, really worse in a way.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of legends about St. Francis, and some say that he that some of the practices that he had were very similar to Asian practices. For example, that he did a lot of silent retreats where he would stay in silence and do a lot of meditation. And let me see if I'm getting this right, where he reached a point where he had like the silence that people talk about when you reach enlightenment. Have you heard that?
Silent mind.
Yeah.
Right. The peace that surpasseth understanding. You know, there's no, it's not about having an idea in your mind. It's just like pure existence, I guess.
Being.
Yeah, I have heard that, and like your guys' interview, which I recommend everybody go back and listen to with Khan. The I don't know, is he a monk? The guy from Japan who you interviewed?
Yeah.
Yeah,
last year. I mean, he was talking about his silent retreats in a cave, and that was amazing. I mean, that, you know. And the thing that he said, that Khan said, which I guess is St. Francis would say, is that anybody can do it, you know. It's just a matter of doing it.
Well, what he told me that I was dying laughing at, I know I've said this many times, he said – that being in a cave in darkness for 21 days was easy. What's hard is having a 9-to-5. And I just fell out of my chair when he said that.
Yeah. That's true. Wow, that's so true. People, it's hard to give up the complications. I guess that's really what it comes down to, you know? It's like people are so willing to settle for less that it's like – and now we're convinced in America, you know, if you – it's kind of like if you don't settle for less, you're an elitist, or you're kind of trying to not pulling your weight. You know, you got to get out there and work. You know, you take some time off and, you know, go on a retreat. You know, some people might accuse you of being lazy.
Yeah. Let's dive back into the books and.
Yeah. And one thing. I mean, I know the hours come to an end, but Oh, I don't know. Is the first hour? No, we got a ways to go. Okay, never mind.
Yeah, we still got half an hour.
Oh, good. Okay. I was just going to say, I wanted to cover some of the aspects of the early heresies, like the Arian heresy and Pelagian, but we don't have to get right into that. Just whatever you guys want.
You open the door. Come on, let's
go. So let's walk in.
Okay. I mean, people... want to know what happened, I guess, you know, with the early church.
First of all, heresy. Is there an official Christian or Catholic definition for what constitutes heresy?
That would be, I mean, up until probably through the first millennium, the Protestants kind of keep the same doctrines. So even like an Episcopalian would have the same concepts of heresy, but it basically contradicts what the bishops taught throughout the first millennium. The Orthodox bishops, this is the Roman Catholic, and the Protestants are called Protestants because they never did go back to the Gnostic tradition. That they just modified the Catholic. They're protesting certain elements of Catholicism. You know, I mean, a Presbyterian is just sort of twice removed from a Catholic. I mean, the seat of power and the seat of doctrine was the Roman Catholic Church. And that's where these theological ideas were hammered out. I mean, what was being taught in the first century is not the same as what was being proclaimed in the fifth century, I guess, by the Roman Catholic Church.
Yeah. Some of the stuff I see, I've been called a heretic before, so, but, in the early church, did you find any, like, for example, with the mythologies, that was still kept in. So I'll give you an example because I know I'm not making any sense now. So, for example, when Catholicism reached over to different cultures, a lot of their own myths and systems became part of it. So, for example, in Latin America, a lot of the deities, or in Africa, a lot of the deities became certain saints.
Yeah, so, Santeria.
Yes, Santeria, voodoo. Wow.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, totally. I mean, it's the same with the Irish. I mean, being
exactly.
Saint Bridget was an Irish goddess, and I mean, we're kind of getting off the early church, but that's fine with me because it all leads back to the same thing. Saint Bridget was an Irish goddess. There's a hymn. A whole chapter of my book is devoted to the hymn to Saint Bridget by Saint Brogan, and it's clearly he's writing an allegory about the Earth goddess Bridget, and that was a fun thing to write. But that was kept in, and I think that they allowed it for the sake of spreading the movement easier. I think that the bishops knew that Bridget was not a real person, but you know, you want to get the people all in the corral, or so you kind of make her a saint. But that's my theory.
Yeah. So is it the same with in reverse? So now we go further back to the Bible, and these people were probably practicing the Egyptian religions or the Sumerian religions or Babylonian. And do you think that with Judaism, that's what was happening, and that's why we have these stories?
Back to like what Tom was talking about, the Book of Revelation is probably the perfect example of a book that's like clearly is full of Gnostic symbolism from pagan cultures and more so even than Judaism, and yet it's the last book of the Bible. I mean, look at 666. You know, that's the infamous number in Revelation. Well, that's in Gnostic traditions. It's also in the Old Testament. I mean, Solomon had 666 talents of gold, and there's 666 returning – a family of 666 returning from Babylonian exile. And that made its way in early. I mean, the Revelation is a Gnostic book, and I think around the time of Constantine they started – The split started. That's the emperor who was the Christian Roman Empire in about 325 AD. I mean, that's when it really became authoritarian. You know, that's – and some of the doctrines. Like before that, I mean, for instance, reincarnation, that's taught in the early – I mean, it's obviously in the early Gnostic traditions, but even early Catholics taught that. I mean, 325 AD was the Council of Nicaea. Where they're arguing with a teacher named Arius about the nature of Jesus Christ. You know, can we be what Jesus was, is the second person of the Trinity, or can we be like that, and are we always subordinate? That was kind of the argument.
Isn't that where he was basically deified at that point? He wasn't really seen God, quote unquote, or a deity up until that point. He was just basically a teacher up until then.
Right, but I guess the people got thrown off by what he taught was, like, even in the conventional gospels, you know, Jesus says, "Do you not know ye are gods?" You know, we're already one with God. So the Arian heresy was to say that we are one with God, the same as Jesus is one with God. The funny thing about the Arian heresy was that on both sides, even on the side of the anti-Arians, you had teachers that still taught reincarnation, like Didymus the Blind was a famous theologian, and that wasn't even the argument. You know what I mean? It was like both sides still taught reincarnation back then, and people say, like, you know, there's no evidence of that in the early church, that there wasn't condemned until, you know, 553 AD, and that's true, like reincarnation. I'm just giving an example of a stunning kind of doctrinal change, and it was taught for so long in so many places that they didn't even get around to officially condemning it till the year 553. So it's kind of a funny thing. You see how diverse the traditions were.
Right.
So in the pre-Jesus, did the Jewish believe in reincarnation?
According to Josephus, they did. And I know, like, Job says, naked I came into this world and naked I will return to my mother's womb. So, you know, what did he mean by that? But, I mean, it's almost everybody believed it back then.
Maybe it was unique if they didn't. It was such common knowledge that it wouldn't have been something that would needed to be written down.
Yeah, and it's in there. I mean, they did write it down, but it wasn't like, hey, guess what? We have something new. It was just so – it was taken for granted. And I think what even with Jesus took it for granted, but he had to correct beliefs. Like some people believed that if you're disfigured, it was a punishment for the sins of another life. And even in the Old Testament, it says, I think it's maybe attributed to Solomon saying, like, being good, I came into the world undefiled because I was so good. But and they asked Jesus if a man was born blind because of something he did in a former lifetime. And he says, no, you know, not at all. He says it's so that the works of God may be made manifest, which is basically saying that this man accepted this so that, you know, to spiritually evolve.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. Our language has come a long ways. You know, I've got as far as being able to explain, ethereal concepts. I don't know exactly how to spit this out. I think our language and the diversity of our vocabulary, the English language in particular, and I'm not sure, you know, not being a linguist myself or knowing any other language besides the one that I am trying to spit out of my mouth. I think we have a very dynamic vocabulary that is able to explain these things that were hard to put down on paper or put into words and make understandable in a form that could be understood by the masses. I think we've developed far enough, and our understanding has developed far enough that that we're able to do that now. We're able to make sense of it now.
Especially compared to Latin. When you look at the Roman, like the Bible for so long was in Latin, and that's kind of a like a brutish kind of language compared to, you know, I mean, English has evolved, but even compared to other, like, you know, Sanskrit and some of these, you know, very, you know, the longer a language has a tradition, the more rich it becomes. And, you know, Latin wasn't a very rich language, and the Bible was put in Latin. So much was lost, really, in that.
Lost in translation.
Yeah. Lost in translation. I mean, even eternal, you know, the word eternal, you will go to, you know, eternal punishment is in the New Testament, but that's the Latin word. The Greek, there's a nuance when they talk about like God's eternal, you know, mercy. That's one word. And the other word that they use for like hellfire, it really translates from Greek into age long, you know, of an eon. And St. Jerome apparently St. Jerome, but one of these Latin translators just took eternal and put it there when they're talking about within time. I mean, he just changed the whole meaning. I mean, you just introduced the concept of eternal damnation with a Latin translation and, you know, proceeded to scare the pants off people for the next, you know, 1500 years.
Yeah. One of the things that I find in translations, I'm learning Japanese now and I speak Spanish and English, and there's many things that, for example, I'll give you a very simple example. If you tell somebody, if we're joking around, say, get out of here, right? Well, for Japanese students learning English, that's very offensive because it's like, why do you want me to get out of here? But that's not what we mean. So I'm sure that's exactly what happened when they were translating. You know, they didn't take the context of what he's talking about. They took the literal meaning. Yeah. And so if I write that down, like, oh, you know, we were at this place and I told so-and-so get out of here. So,
then so you're like, you're full of soup. And they're like, I have not eaten any soup today. Why do you keep telling
exactly.
me?
Right.
Exactly. So I'm sure these guys didn't understand context.
I think there was a combination of things going on through the translations. I think some of it was innocent, just you know, like we were just talking there, just misinterpretation or that sort of thing. But I also think that there was a manipulative finger in the pie also to, you know, get some of the let's say the planned reactions and controlling factors inserted into the book also.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, when you, like, I don't know about you, Ramon, but Tom, when you were in your, like, kind of fundamentalist phase, did you feel yourself motivated by, like, a fear of hell a little bit to, like, a motivation? Because I know I did. That was kind of an impetus for me to act a certain way, or, like, I better just keep on this path because the consequences are going to be bad if I...
There was a certain amount of that. It was, yeah. But...
The threat that they introduced kind of keeps people in line. I mean, look at the medieval paintings. These churches, there's pictures of just like all these people in agony, you know, like wailing and, you know, being tortured by and people loved it. And then like Hieronymus Bosch took it to another level and it just made it like this really bizarre, you know, abstract art of like hellish tortures, and he lived in the woods and people would go for miles just to look at his crazy pictures, which are pretty cool in a way, but you know, they're bizarre. But I think it was like it's kind of like playing on people's those lower emotions. What do they say? Yeah. Like the root chakra is kind of the survival, and they you can just push that button all the time, that lower, you know, fear button, you know, you're push people worrying about their, you know, where they're going to go in the next life, and they don't really ascend to the higher planes if they're just acting out of fear, you know.
So is hell is not really even in the Bible?
Not really. I mean, except in the sense maybe similar to Buddhism in the sense of karma. You know, you meet what you create. And, I mean, you could call that, I mean, hell, I mean, you have to deal with your own garbage, you know, and Jesus talked about the garbage dump outside of Jerusalem called Gehenna, you know, and he's like, you got to reckon with your own Gehenna, you know, and I forget exactly how he put it, but, you can't just throw garbage out there in the world and not, you know, not expect to have to take responsibility for it.
Right. But this whole place about, this whole idea about a place called hell that's, you know, down below the fires of hell, was that all Dante's fault? Or, I
think he definitely created the, you know, really riffed on, you know, this kind of medieval idea that was congealing, and then he took it to another level. But yeah, in the early times, I don't think that anybody had a concept of that, you know, I mean, of this place of torture underground. There was a concept of maybe a kind of an other world underground. And that was, I mean, if you went to Ireland, that was kind of the fairy realm, you know, the mystical other world, you know, under the hills and underground. And it certainly wasn't considered evil. It was, you know, another realm.
Have you found any references to inner earth type stuff in the Bible?
No. The closest thing I found was a reference, in a sense, maybe to Atlantis, in terms of that Atlantis sank below the earth, you know, below the waves and below the earth. And that's in Job, where it says the Rephaim writhe in their prison under the ocean. And that ties into the whole Atlantis myth. The Rephaim, just to sum it up real quick, are these Jewish version of the Titans of Greek lore, who were put down in Atlantis. And kind of that has a thing like where their prison is under the earth. But in terms of similar to the Celtic idea of the other world under the earth, or the fairy world under the earth, and the Norse have that, and the Chinese have it, and even their like little fairies are the same, you know, they have them wearing these little red caps. It's really interesting, and like all over the world, some of the American Indians have these little red cap, you know, I don't know if they're nature intelligences or
Amanita muscaria.
what's that?
Amanita muscaria.
yeah right, the mushroom. Well, I'm sure there's, if you really want to see them, you know.
Yeah.
You eat a couple of those red caps, and
that reminds me of the song "Fairy Wear Boots." And by Black Sabbath?
Yeah. I saw it. I saw it with my own two eyes.
Yeah. Speaking of fairies, I really want to get into the Irish folk tales.
So
for the Irish Celtic stories, how what was their main message from the Druids and
yeah, I mean, to start with, like, about the fairies, that was part of my mother-in-law tells me that her grandmother, who was from Ireland, believed in fairies until about 1965. I mean, a lot of people still do, but it's just part of the culture, and they couldn't convert them away from that. I mean, you know, whatever the Orthodox bishops were saying in Ireland, everybody had their beliefs, and you better leave, you know, something out for the fairies on, you know, certain nights of the year when it was appropriate, or you know, things aren't going to go well for you, because there's a certain way to interact with that world according to their beliefs. And it never really went away. And I'm sure that was part of Druidism too, because they were the culture, they preserved the culture, you know, for thousands of years until it became Christian. And a lot of those Druids apparently had no problem with Christianity, you know, in its original form, because it wasn't nobody marched into Ireland with or England, which was also Celtic in the first century. Nobody marched in there with a Bible saying, you know, put your hand on this legal document. You know, it was much more about like sharing common truths. You know, Joseph of Arimathea was the one, according to the, you know, old Welsh manuscripts and Scottish manuscripts and, you know, early French manuscripts, who along with several others, brought Christianity to the British Isles, you know, in the first century. And it was like a very Gnostic form. But as far as the Druids, I mean, their motto, according to the, you know, early writings, was truth against the world. You know, they were interested in truth, and they were really naturalists and natural scientists. They were described as Pythagoreans, which was something that was always said of the Christian Gnostics, that they were Pythagoreans. And Pelagius, for instance, was an Irish monk who, in the 4th century, a huge controversy started around him, and he was labeled a Pythagorean. And, you know, he taught, you know, he argued with St. Augustine that, you know, he said there is no original sin. And, you know, according to his writings don't survive, but it seems pretty clear to me, which I wrote in the book, that he was carrying on the Celtic Christian belief, which was the same as the Druid belief. I mean, they had the idea of reincarnation and the belief in that, and they had a belief in, I don't know, you call it just like spiritual ascension, you know, into enlightenment. And they were natural philosophers as well.
Great stuff. Well, we're going to get into a whole lot more here in our second hour. This first hour is pretty much flown by. And
oh wow, yeah.
Yeah. So we definitely want to get into you've got a pretty cool chapter on Atlantis and then the star beings and that sort of thing. We'll get into all that in the second hour, and we'll just have some more good chat. So Dan, where can people get a hold of your books at?
Or get a hold of you.
Sure, me or my book, www.paganstreams, that's all one word, and that's pagan, STREAMS, not dreams, streams, like rivers, and .com. And I have to say that name was influenced by a Van Morrison song that I really like. But so I have – you can order my book through that website, and there's probably a link to my album, and there's a link to your radio show and a lot of other cool shows that I like, and, you know, wild and woolly kind of things that are out there.
Okay. Okay. Well, I want to thank everybody for listening to the first hour here, and stay tuned for Mr. Brooks Agnew coming up next, and then pop on over and jump in the members section and check out the second hour.
Yay!
Condemnation without investigation is the height of ignorance.
And the love you deny is the pain you carry.
All right. We'll see you in the member section.